Thank you. James Gale?
Thank you, Dan. I will follow in the trend so far established and open with a couple of reflections on the process. And one of the things that's become clear to me through my sometimes almost non-participation in this project, although I've been part of it for over 3.5 years, but it's kept holding meetings that I can't attend, so I'm quite pleased that finally, for the final meeting, I am able to be here, is the way things go on and how each group and each of the individuals involved seems to have had their own experience of this process, which in itself probably is a topic for a future research project, informing the social processes of research and understanding how each bit of it fits together and comes to a conclusion. In saying that, without going into any of the tedious detail, that this paper is one of those which is further behind than most of the others. I guess this supposed final meeting or final meeting with supposed everything finished is about 7/10 finished in practice, and this is one of the papers which still has to go through some parts of the process. In saying that, part of that process has been the way in which I have learned as I've gone more into it and relearned, because when I was first asked to be involved, I'd done a lot of work on Kosovo and NATO, and I was kind of doing quite a bit about it while it was happening. And as I've gone on, I kind of think it's always interesting. You find the odd little extra thing that, although you thought you knew all about it, there's the odd little extra thing you don't know about. And then you find the odd little thing which makes you think, well, maybe that's slightly different. And so it's testimony to the virtue of the continuing process that even those of us who thought we'd put something behind us at some stage can be forced back into it and get something out of it. The other thing I'd say is that about sources, I've found in doing this, if anybody's interested, three particularly useful sources. One is a book by Alex Bellamy, which, if people aren't aware of it and haven't seen it, it would be very useful to go and look at. The second is a collection of documents. And I'm looking quickly because I can't remember the German guy who's put at the Cambridge University Press. It's incomplete, which is frustrating, because I know I can see some of the things that he's missed. But if you want to go to one source where you can get so much of the material and information relating to this, that is it. It's in the paper anyway. Just trying to find the thing note there. Yes, Heike Krieger, if anybody's interested. And the third is Brooke Lapping, who did research for two mammoth television documentary series. One, The Death of Yugoslavia, also known as Yugoslavia, Death of a Nation. And after that, The Fall of Milosevic, which is based on doing film interviews with participants, with actors themselves. So you've got an enormous amount of first-hand testimony from those who were doing things. And the methodology used means that each of them is put against the other as part of the research process to say, well, so-and-so is saying this. What do you say? And everybody feels that they have to say their bit of it and go on record. Of course, there are holes because in both parts of that framework and methodology, bits are missing. But if anybody's interested in following through and doing more, and the original film interviews, I should also advertise for some of those, are in the archives at King's in London. The one other thing I would say about this particular paper is the structure. And one of the reasons that it hasn't gone further in the process so far is that at least one person in this room has a question about the approach that has been taken so far on the structure. The structure is not chronological. The key question that was put to us concerned the Rambouillet negotiations. And I think that the way the paper is structured is to leave that as the focal point, the centre of gravity. And so what we do is look at motivations first, then actual conduct subsequently, and use both of those to cast light then on trying to work out what the key issue about the negotiations was. But that's something which anybody who looks at this paper, it's possible that might change, but not if I have my way. We were given a series of questions, and just for the record, I'll read them out first of all, and then I'll revisit what the basic conclusions are on each of them. The key question was the Rambouillet diktat justified, which of course involves the sub-question of was it indeed a diktat in the first place. I stress these were received questions. It's quite an unusual part of the process as well that I'm used to thinking of my own questions, going investigating, working out what's interesting about something. Here you're put into a set structure, and not having participated in any of the meetings where those involved set this pattern of questions, I've not been allowed at any stage really to revisit them or challenge them or question them. Every time I say, well, I'm told, well, no, that's the mission, that's what they're. So if anybody wants to complain, I'm just following orders. And then the subsequent set of questions, subordinate questions. What motivated the US and the NATO allies? What would have happened in Kosovo without the NATO intervention? Did NATO violate international law in carrying out its action? What was the extent of war crimes committed by Yugoslav military Serbian MUP units? And finally, did anyone flee NATO bombs? So those are the set questions that we were working with. And what I'm going to do now is give you a run through any of the material, but just the key points of conclusion, which, as I stress, are interim points of conclusion and might be subject to change. So first of all, on the motivations, what did motivate NATO and its member states? I think I can identify three factors feeding into it. One, fairly self-evidently, if you begin to think about it, is the experience of Bosnia. There's a track record, of actions taken by Belgrade, and a track record of engagement with Belgrade on trying to handle those issues. The second is direct evidence from the 1998, early 99 period of Belgrade action in Kosovo, which appears to be consistent with things that had been seen before in the 1990s. So not only do you have the track record of problems and of engaging with them and building up a way of trying to work out what to do about Belgrade and in particular about Milosevic, but you also have this kind of new trend, 98-99, of similar pattern of activity in Kosovo. And the third thing is that there was absolutely a clear belief among those involved of the imminent prospect of renewed Serbian campaign at the end of March. And so with evidence of what had been done in the past and the character assessment of the regime, and with a complete belief based on various sources of information that a new campaign would begin in late March, the real aim was to prevent. The motivation was to prevent that campaign if possible, and if it weren't possible to prevent it, then to limit it. And although in the end the use of air power was the thrust, the primary motivation before that seems clearly to have been to get an agreement which would permit a ground force to be deployed in Kosovo, one which would then be an obstacle to the expected campaign, which would effectively make that use of force impossible. And that's one of the reasons why Rambouillet becomes central, because the point of going to Rambouillet is to get the agreement, whatever the agreement is, which permits a force to be deployed. The aim is to avoid using force. And I think that's the crucial thing to be understood in this process, and to get to a position where you can deploy a force without actually using destructive force to prevent any further use of force and blocking the Serbian campaign. What happens in Kosovo without NATO intervention? Well, this is, of course, one of those impossible questions, because none of us can ever go back and run that separate track of history again and see what would have happened if this other thing had been different. But I think, without giving a complete answer, we can point to some things which suggest that it's likely above all, that there would have been a Serbian campaign and that there would have been the kind of extensive ethnic cleansing that took place anyway. It's crucial to note that the Serbian campaign in Kosovo in March 1999 began on the 19th, 20th of March, which is 4 or 5 days before the NATO campaign. And one of the issues that goes around in the eternal debates is, you know, did the NATO action provoke Serbian ethnic cleansing? Well, and you know, the tiny bit of chronological record seems to suggest no, it didn't. The campaign had begun before the NATO action began. That was only as a result of the failure to get an agreement in France about that would have prevented any of it happening. Another thing to note is probably, and this again counterfactual, semi-speculation, but based on the evidence of 1998 and the early part, and indeed the whole of the campaign in 1999, is that the Kosovo Liberation Army would not have been successful in a way that it appeared to be or judged itself to be later on. The evidence was that every time Belgrade forces decided enough was enough and to turn round, they would roll up the Kosovo Liberation Army. That doesn't mean to say that it would have been wiped out. Another of the elements in this, I think we conclude, is that it would likely just have been an asymmetric conflict continuing for a very long time, because you know, being wound up, rolled over doesn't mean to say that you cease to exist and that the thing for which you're fighting goes away. Now to some of the really controversial areas. Did NATO violate international law? And I think there are two key issues here, two different aspects to it. The first was the lawfulness of the action itself. And on the one hand, the record shows that each of the members of the alliance believed that the action was lawful. But there is a question about it, because they couldn't bring themselves to agree on one single interpretation of what constituted a lawful basis for that action. In the end, Javier Solana, then NATO Secretary General, carried out a clever bit of diplomacy, recognizing all of this after months of failing to agree on what the legal basis for action would be. It was the one box remaining to be checked. And he said, well, do we all agree that it would be lawful? Nobody spoke against it. And so he said, right, that's the box checked, off we go. And that's one of the reasons why the contention continues, because there was no clearly, and there could not be any clearly stated legal basis for the action, because the allies themselves couldn't agree on what that was, even though each had its own interpretation of what made it lawful. Of course, a kind of supplementary dimension to that is that there was a proposal to the UN Security Council by three member states, two of them permanent, to have a Security Council resolution to condemn the action as unlawful, which actually came to a vote but was defeated 12-3, which doesn't say that it was lawful, but it kind of adds to a legitimacy in the discussion about the issues of legality and lawfulness. The fragility about the legal basis for the action, which, as I say, will be contested and remains to be contested, feeds into the other aspect, which is the suspicion of commission of war crimes. On one side, I think it's fairly clear that war crimes were committed and international crimes were committed by Belgrade forces. There's a substantial body of evidence being brought forward at the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, which doesn't have to go to criminal conviction before it can be used as evidence of things that actually took place. Whether or not particular individuals are criminally liable is not the same thing as recognizing that those things took place. Secondly, I think we can say that there were clearly cases also confirmed by indictments and the beginning of trial procedures against Kosovo Albanians that the Kosovo Liberation Army was also responsible for certain actions that can be described as crimes. But I think one of the key contentious issues, and that's kind of the extent I've run into the next bit, which is the extent of war crimes committed by Serbian forces. But I think there's a contentious issue also over the NATO action, which is made all the more sensitive because of the uncertain legal basis for NATO's action in the first place. Did NATO, any of the NATO action, constitute something which might have warranted an indictment by the tribunal in The Hague? And while the prosecutor's office investigated a number of prima facie cases, I think we can point to one issue where we can say, and no more than this, that there might be a case still to investigate and answer, and that's the use of cluster munitions. And cluster munitions per se, and the particular use of cluster munitions, for example, against airfields located within the urban area of Niche, highly unreliable munitions, not necessarily intended usually for that kind of purpose, high risk of civilian collateral damage, and particularly in the case of Niche where one of them just went wrong anyway, and issues which create great sensitivities. And the reason we can point to this is that although the prosecutor's office in its report on suspected alleged NATO crimes did a fairly good and thorough job of looking at all the other issues, it had one cursory paragraph on general principles relating to the use of cluster munitions and then passed on. And it strikes me that if you look at the fairly cursory approach to that topic, pitched against the issues of necessity and proportionality and the potential other issues there, that we can say it's one of those, it's an area in which there can be further discussion. We conclude on all that. And so finally, with all of this, was the Rambouillet diktat justified? Well, I think if you look at the motivations, and the evidence of motivations is that the Allies, in their different ways, were certainly trying to prevent anything happening and to get agreement for a force which would prevent further acts of ethnic cleansing, further things that could be described as crimes. And if you look at the subsequent conduct with enormous disputes, lack of preparedness to pursue the air campaign, enormous disputes politically and militarily about conceptualization, strategy, operations, tactics, you have to say that if anybody really was putting this up as a pretext for action, that what they really wanted to do was bomb, they must be even more incompetent than anybody could imagine that they possibly could be. I think it's fairly clear that the way it was struck, which is not to say that there weren't some people who were really keen to get on with bombing. That's not the same thing. There were some people who were keen to see it happen. But I think overall, the point was to avoid using destructive force, and to have the threat of destructive force really is a way of coercing people into an agreement. And I'll, away from the paper, I'll say as a personal judgment, and that seems to me was a misreading of lessons that people believe they'd learned from Bosnia, because they were captured. That was a different situation and different lessons. So with all of that, I think we can say that the crunch point, then, going back to Rambouillet, was it a diktat? Well, certainly it was some kind of ultimatum. There was clearly an ultimatum there that if there wasn't agreement, and particularly if Belgrade wasn't party to the agreement, then destructive force would be used. It seems to me very likely that the interpretation we should put is that Milosevic decided to call NATO's bluff on the assumption that they wouldn't actually resort to a use of destructive force, or probably well informed that the assumptions were that even if they did, it would only be for 2 or 3 days, maximum of a week. Maybe there was an option even to extend to 2 weeks, but we can call their bluff one way or the other. Evidence that Milosevic was set on conflict is crucial, and I think there are two things to look at. First, the political elements of the Rambouillet agreements, would-be agreements. When there was a failure to get a final deal at Rambouillet, partly because the Kosovo Albanians were kind of having to go back and check on their position before they would really agree to it, there were kind of 6 or 7 small areas of difference. The political part of the agreement was very close. Nothing that couldn't have been worked out or set aside or overlooked. When Belgrade came back to the follow-up talks in Paris, it brought a completely new counter-proposal, which made it look as though it was not taking it seriously at all. Yeah, had no intention on trying to get a final agreement, narrow those small outstanding areas on the political side. It just seemed to want to throw the whole thing away. And the other thing, but the other part of that is the thing which is held up as the great canard in all of this, and that's the military annex for implementation that was proposed. And I think if you look at this closely, not only can you see that the annex that was proposed was so relatively weak and feeble vis-a-vis that which was finally accepted as terms for military implementation after the bombing, the annex for military implementation, the whole agreement would have left Yugoslav military forces in Kosovo, would have left the Serbian MUP in Kosovo. The final agreement had neither of those. But crucially, the idea that this was some kind of diktat with this non-negotiable kind of insistence on deploying a force which would have rights to move throughout the whole of Serbia and Montenegro, only to move, not actually to do anything in the rest of Serbia and Montenegro, would only be permitted to do narrow military missions in Kosovo, could have been changed. And that's the crucial thing to understand. Milosevic was given the chance. US negotiators in particular went out of their way to try to give him one last chance. Madeleine Albright, it turned out later, even what has been slightly humiliating for her, arranged a phone call with him to try and persuade him to pull out of this. Holbrooke famously went on a last-minute mission to say, come on, come away from this. But for me, the most compelling of all is Christopher Hill, who was there in the room with Milosevic. Milosevic told him this is completely unacceptable. Hill offered him the pen and said, change it. Yeah, you suggest the changes, what will be, and Milosevic folded his arms and didn't say another word. And Hill, after a while, took his leave and said, okay, well, I'll go. And after that, Holbrooke went back for that last time. I think if you look at the evidence and the efforts to try and get some kind of agreement, try and get Milosevic to play, and on the other hand, his absolute rejection, both of the political things which had almost been agreed, and of any sense of trying to change the military annex so you could work, find a way forward, it seems to me you get to the answer that it not only was it not per se a diktat, but it was some kind of ultimatum, but it certainly wasn't a pretext. And the evidence suggests that people were trying to do what they could to avoid having to use bombs rather than rushing to use them.